Well, thank you, Jill, for that excellent and very kind introduction. Thank you all for being here. It's a real pleasure to be here in Boston and to see a room full of people when there are so many other interesting things you can do in Boston. I'm not sure I would come to my own lecture knowing all the other things that you can do on an evening like tonight in Boston. So thank you all for being here. Thank you again, Jill, for the introduction, for the inspiration, for your leadership on so many issues, and for really connecting the dots between all these different important issues and realizing that it's really all the same struggle. I think that's really important. People often say, well, you know, Israel is the response to the Holocaust. And it's very strange because so many Holocaust survivors disagreed from the very beginning, of course, didn't go to Israel. Most of them, you know, stayed in other places, but opted to go to other places, return to their own homes. But this idea that the suffering of one nation somehow can be the solution for the suffering of another nation is so absurd. Sadly, so many people have bought into this idea that that's what Israel is all about, and that's why Israel should be what it should be. There's a wonderful Palestinian writer by the name of Hassan Kanafani. I don't know if any of you heard of him. But if you haven't, you should, because his short stories, are the best way to understand Palestine. Reading Hassan Kanafani is really the most important thing we can do to really understand what happened in Palestine. Now, Hassan Kanafani was killed by the Israelis, was assassinated very brutally in 1972 in Beirut. He was also one of the leaders of the PFLP, which was the leftist portion of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. And he and his 16-year-old niece were both blown up by the Israelis in Beirut. But recently, about 6-8 months ago, an interview with Hassan Kanafani surfaced online. It's very short. It's maybe 4 or 5 minutes long. I really urge you to look it up. It's in English. He's in Beirut in his office. And he's being interviewed by an Australian journalist. And probably the most remarkable thing about the interview is his demand for clarity. And when we talk about Palestine, clarity is something that is lacking. People call it a dispute. People call it an occupation. People call it a liberation. People call it this. People call it that. They call it Israel. They call it Palestine. People call it a conflict. People call it a war. In this interview, Hassan Kanafani does not accept that premise at all.
Could you spell the last name?
Kanafani, K-A-N-A-F-A-N, like Nancy, I, Kanafani. And he insists that this is the struggle of a nation for liberation, the struggle to be allowed to return to your homes, a struggle of a nation that has been dispossessed, kicked out of their land, and forgotten by the rest of the world, and living in abject poverty in refugee camps. He goes on to say things that we are used to hearing white people say and accepting, like that Palestinians will fight to the last drop of blood. Palestinians would rather die standing. Things that, you know, we hear in other contexts and we think heroism, but when a Palestinian says it, of course, he's a terrorist. Because if a Palestinian says he's going to fight and he would rather die standing, then he must be a terrorist. And of course, we know that Palestinians are killed whether they're standing or lying in their beds. And they have been killed like this for the last 7 decades. He just says it in a way that is absolutely so clear. And I watched it over and over again. I still watch it from time to time. I think it's really, really important, like I said, to read his work, but also and also to listen to this interview. And at one point, the reporter says to him, well, why don't you speak to the Israelis? And Hassan Kanafani pauses. He looks up at the journalist and he says, talk about what? And he says, peace, of course. So he pauses again and he says, you mean capitulation. And then he says that for Palestinians to talk, to negotiate with Israelis, We said it would be a very strange conversation. He said it would be like a conversation between the sword and the neck. And we know, this was 1970, mind you, we know that every time the Palestinians did try to negotiate, did try to talk to the Israelis, the Israeli sword has gone deeper, cut deeper and deeper into the Palestinian neck. That is exactly what has happened when Palestinians did try to negotiate. And again, talking about the importance of this clarity, what do people call the country? When people go to visit, they'll say, oh, I visited Israel and I visited Palestine. Or I visited Israel-Palestine. Or I visited Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Well, which is it? If we say occupied Palestinian territories, that kind of suggests that there are somewhere Palestinian territories, the territories that are not occupied. Well, where are those Palestinian territories that are not occupied? There is no such thing. All of Palestine is occupied. There is no Israel and Palestine. There is no state of Palestine. It's both, really, because it depends on where you stand on the issue, whether you call it Israel or Palestine. Because either way, you're talking about the entire country. So if we accept that it's Israel, then we are legitimizing a 7-decade-long settler colonial project that has been engaged in a vicious campaign of genocide and ethnic cleansing against the local indigenous population. That's what Zionism is. That's what Israel is. If we accept that the country is called Israel, then we are legitimizing what Israel has done. If we accept that people have a right to freedom, have a right to live, have a right to return to their homes, if we believe in justice and equality, then it's Palestine. If we reject settler colonialism, if we reject racism, then we have to call it Palestine. The name of the country is Palestine. And I think for people of conscience, and I suspect everybody in this room today qualifies within that community of people of conscience, or what's called the constituency of conscience, I think it's important for us to be clear, because if we're not clear, certainly other people are not going to be clear. So when I talk about that country, I call it Palestine. And I'm, of course, you know, I'm called an Israeli. It's Palestine, because I will not accept, I reject this notion that I could legitimize this project of settler colonialism, ethnic cleansing, and genocide, especially as someone whose family has been heavily engaged in that process for about 100 years now, going back to my grandparents. Now, again, for me, like you heard, I come from this very Zionist sphere, from a very Zionist family who's been involved. My grandfather was a signer on the Israeli Declaration of Independence. He was a young Zionist at the turn of the century. I have a poster at home advertising his lectures in Kiev in 1920, speaking about the situation in the land of Israel, you know. And he was part of that group of young Zionists who were really the diplomatic corps who went to the world and pretended that they represent Jewish people. And the reason they were successful is because they were highly educated. They were European. They were white. They spoke several languages. They shaved their beards. They didn't look like Jews. And so, you know, the countries, the powers that be of the time really accepted their narrative. But that's where I came from. And of course, both my parents were born in Palestine. And my father was a young officer in 1948. We were, of course, growing up very proud of that, because those were the people who handed us the land of Israel on a silver platter. And then he was a general in 1967. And then, as an Israeli, where the military is above everything, that generation of the generals of the 1967 war, were the gods of the Olympus. You could not wish to have anything greater than that as a father. Because those were the ones, everybody knew their names, everybody knew what they did, where they came from, where they fought, I mean everything. These were the gods of the Olympus. And so, you know, the subtitle of my book is Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. To me, the second part is much more interesting, because the journey goes on. But what is that journey when you're talking about such a small country? I mean, geographically speaking, distance, in terms of distance, it's a very short journey. Palestine is a very small country. And as an Israeli growing up, you know, Palestinians are never more than 10-minute drive. I mean, there's a Palestinian community everywhere. Sometimes the communities are across the street from each other. But the segregation is so deep and so effective that you don't see them. They don't even know they exist. I mean, you know they exist, but you don't know that they exist. So my journey is really the journey of the privileged settler, you know, coming from the privileged settler colonial sphere into the sphere of the other, the native. The one who's darker, the one who's dirty, the one who's violent, the one that can't be trusted, the one that's lazy, and on and on and on, all these things that we know to say about the other. When we come. So that was really the journey of that sphere. So geographically speaking, distance-wise, the journey is very short. Politically, psychologically, it was an enormous journey, because we are taught that we can't, you know, this is dangerous. It's a dangerous thing. Today, there's a wall, and there are checkpoints, and there are big signs as you cross a checkpoint from one side to the other, warning you in Hebrew, some of them are in English too now, that you're about to enter Palestinian territories, that it's a felony to enter Palestinian territories, and that it is life-threatening. And it's interesting, because at the end they always have like two or three exclamation marks. Because if you're not impressed by the fact that you might be killed or you're committing a felony, then of course you need the exclamation marks to, you know, drive the point through, across. It is insane. And when you get to that point, there's no way that you don't think twice and go, okay, do I really want to do this? So that is the journey. Now, I cross them all the time now. I don't even see them anymore, those signs. But in the beginning, this was a difficult journey to take, even though, again, like I said, geographically and distance-wise, it's a very short journey. And having taken that journey, what do you see? Why are the Palestinian towns, and you hear this from people who visit all the time, especially if they're visiting, you know, Israel. The Palestinian side is dusty. The lawns are not green. The houses don't seem to be quite as clean. It's kind of dirty and just, you know, run down. What's wrong with them? What's wrong with these Arabs? Look at what a beautiful job the Jews did, you know, in making the desert bloom. And look at this, you know. And sometimes it's across the street. And you have to wonder, what is it? What's wrong with them? What you don't know is, unless you investigate, that Palestinians receive 3% of the water. They're allocated. Israel has its own water authority, Mekorot, which is also, by the way, one of the targets of the BDS movement, because they're exporting their knowledge on how to make the desert bloom. So Mekorot controls all of the water. Palestinians are allocated 3% of the water. Now, sometimes what that means is that a Palestinian town will get 10 or 12 hours of water per week. When exactly the water will be available, nobody really knows for sure. But when you know all you have is 12 hours of water per week and you have a family, you have to prioritize. Across the street, you have Israeli towns, Israeli settlements. They get all the water they need, more than they need. There's no limit on the amount of water you get as an Israeli. You wouldn't dream of not having water in the tap for a shower, for laundry, for watering your plants, to drinking. I mean, that's not even an issue. So of course everything is green and clean and looks wonderful. If you don't know that this is the reality, you don't know. And certainly, unless you're going to shoot someone, denying them water is a pretty sure way of killing them. So this is the reality. So again, having taken that journey, I realize this. I also realize that they live under different laws. You know, we grew up thinking, and here in America, certainly people certainly believe that Israel is a democracy. And look, they even have Arabs in the parliament, in the Knesset, and they vote. Of course it's a democracy, and they get to ride the bus. What we don't know, unless we investigate, is those, I'm talking about the citizens, the Palestinians who do have Israeli citizenship, in what is called, again, this is one of those ridiculous terms, Israel proper. Which is Israel pre-1967, they do not live under the same laws. They do not live in the same reality. They do not enjoy the same privileges. They do get to vote. But everybody knows how they vote. And in the Israeli Knesset, they know exactly how many members they're going to have. So no important decisions are ever made where they have to rely on them for a vote. They're excluded from everything. So it's a very it's a very effective system, really, of ignoring the other while allowing them to vote. They figured it out quite well. And really, the Palestinians who are Israeli citizens live under the control of the Israeli secret police, which is called the Shabak. Not, you know, the model is taken from many of the Arab countries where all the citizens, or other dictatorships where the citizenship is really citizenry, all live under the secret police. So Palestinians who are Israeli citizens live under that. And I'll give you an interesting example. Now, besides that, there are dozens of laws that the Israeli Knesset passed that discriminate against those people specifically. For example, you know, the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe. May 15th is Nakba Day. State institutions are not allowed to mention the Nakba, or they will lose funding. So a gentleman that I know is the vice principal of a Palestinian school. And apparently, last year, during Nakba Day, one of the teachers hinted, maybe they wore a kufiya or something, I'm not sure, but they hinted in class. The next morning, the principal got a phone call from the intelligence department within the education department. In other words, the education department has an intelligence office which deals with the Arabs. And they already knew that next morning that a teacher in that school mentioned the Nakba. And they called to reprimand the principal and tell him to warn the teachers. Okay, that's how they operate. That would never happen in Israel to an Israeli Jewish teacher. That will never happen. No such thing exists. So they don't live under different laws. They don't live under different reality. They don't have the same same resources. There are no similarities at all. It's a completely different life. It's a completely different sphere. Then you have the Palestinians who live in the West Bank who live under military law. An entirely different story. And then you have the Palestinians who live in Jerusalem who live under different laws, a different status. So I grew up, I'm from Jerusalem. I've been out of the country for more than 20 years. I don't lose my citizenship, I can come, I can go, I have a house, no one's going to take my house away. A Palestinian from Jerusalem, if they have another passport, if they have another citizenship, their ID is taken. They can't come back. They can come back as a tourist. Their land is taken away. Their homes are taken away. An entirely different system. Now, if you don't take the journey, you're not going to know. If you don't take the journey, if you don't go to the other side, how will you know? We always assume that, you know, if they're dirty, it's probably because there's something wrong with them. If they are in prison, that's because something is wrong with them. If they are killed by the soldiers or the police, there's probably something wrong with them. Because we are okay. We're good people. Look at us. I mean, after all, we're Jews, we're Israelis, and so on. We're the good guys here. So that is that. That's the value of the journey. And again, like I said, that's why, for me, that part of the story, besides the fact that it's ongoing and it's still going on, is really the more interesting part of that. Now, the whole idea of this two-state solution, where the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are supposedly one part, the rest of the country is another part, exists in order to do one thing. It exists in order to legitimize the conquest and the occupation of 1948, and allow time to go by while the second part, or the completion of the occupation, when Israel took the West Bank and Gaza, becomes, you know, irreversible. That's what it's about. There hasn't been any intent on the Israeli part to ever allow the Palestinians any kind of recognition, any kind of rights, or recognition of any of their rights. But it was a great tactic, and it worked. Today, there is no West Bank. There is no West Bank. There's a Judea and Samaria regions of the state of Israel. They have the police force. The police force have a little pin. The pin is the map of the West Bank, and it says Judea and Samaria. Any bureaucracy that you can think of, state bureaucracy, is available there, but only to the Jewish citizens. Palestinians live under military law. They're governed by the military. So if I'm in the West Bank, in a village, in a protest, and I get arrested, I go through a certain path. A Palestinian arrested in the same place for the same violation has an entirely different experience. You know, I get taken to the police, I get to see my lawyer, I get to call a lawyer at the end of the day. Last time, I didn't get to go home. They insisted to keep me in, to lock me up for 24 hours. But normally, I go home. A Palestinian is thrown in prison, beaten, tortured, and kept in a cell for as long as some officer decides. It could be a year, it could be a month, it could be a day. Nobody knows. And a Palestinian will not see a lawyer until they confess. They will not see a lawyer until they confess. So they have to be tortured. Again, there is no equality. There is no democracy. Now, people talk about the one state solution, so to speak, as though it is something futuristic, as though we have this option. We can opt for one state. We can opt for two states. We have all these options like a buffet. There is no option. Israel created a single state over all of Palestine with exclusive rights for Jewish people, period. Period. It's done. There are no parts of the country where you can slice off and say, well, this will be a Palestine, this will be an Israel. There's no such place. I mean, the two populations live in such proximity, it's impossible to do. It wouldn't be the right thing to do anyway, but it would be impossible. So today there's a single state. Now, the thing that people don't like to hear is the word apartheid. The thing that people don't like to hear is ethnic cleansing, and the thing that people the most don't want to hear is genocide. How can you say that Jews would be engaged in genocide? My thing is, the words offend you? You're offended by the words? You're not offended by the actions? You're not offended by the fact that different populations live under different laws? That we who are settlers and the children of settlers have privileges that the people whose land this is can't enjoy? Never mind the ones who have been kicked out and are living in refugee camps? That doesn't bother you? A campaign of ethnic cleansing that's been going on for 7 decades. Ethnic cleansing, planned, well thought out, well executed. Still going on today in Jerusalem, in Hebron, in the Negev Desert in the south, where there are supposedly Israeli citizens. Thousands and thousands of people being kicked off their lands, villages being destroyed, homes being destroyed. That doesn't bother you? This methodical campaign of ethnic cleansing doesn't bother you? The name is the problem? And genocide. How can you say that Jews would ever be involved in genocide? Well, there's a Geneva Convention. Look at the definition of the crime of genocide. Compare that to what Israel has been doing for 7 decades. A destruction of a people. A destruction of a people. Can anybody say that Israel has not been engaged in the destruction of the Palestinian people? Monuments? Land? Changing names? Not to mention changing the name of the entire country, but changing names of places? Allowing historical monuments to fall apart? Keeping people under such strict rules that you know they're going to die? And in the Geneva Convention, it clarifies that there has to be intent. In other words, if you kill 1,000 people but there was no intent, then it's not genocide. Fine. If we look at the record of the state of Israel over the last 7 decades, can anyone have any doubt? Is there any doubt that there was intent? When we see the plans, we see the execution. How can there be any doubt that there's... When it was... It's interesting. In 2014... Was it 2014? Maybe it was 2008. One of the massacres in Gaza. After one of the massacres in Gaza, the UN decided to send in a... to investigate. To see if war crimes took place. To see if war crimes took place in Gaza. They needed a committee to go in and investigate if war crimes were committed. The fact that warplanes dropped millions of tons of bombs on a civilian population that had nowhere to go, that's not enough proof? You need a committee to investigate if there were war crimes? So this whole idea that somehow that we need to investigate whether there was intent, we need to make sure, of course there's intent. When you drop 1 million tons of bombs on a civilian population, you know you're going to kill them. and then we do it again, and then you do it again, and then you do it again. So I don't think genocide is problematic. Genocide is what's been going on. And until we speak clearly about this, and until we use the exact terms, the precise terms, to describe Israel, to describe what Israel has done, to describe the reality in Palestine, it's not going to change. Because we are the voice of the constituency of conscience. We're the people that are bringing out the message. And the one thing that people often say, yes, but our Jewish friends, you know, it really hurts their feelings. We don't want to offend our Jewish neighbors. I can understand that. But if these Jewish neighbors support racism, apartheid, and genocide, why are they your friends to begin with? You know, why do you tolerate this? So these are all important issues. But again, going back to this idea of the one state exists. And in many ways, I think we owe a debt, not a debt, but we should thank Donald Trump for bringing the conversation to a point where the conversation, not just the two-state solution, it's been dead for a long, it was dead on arrival, but the two-state solution conversation is now over. And he empowered members of the Israeli government to speak more honestly now as well. I mean, they never intended to allow Palestinians to have their own state or make peace with them, but they pretended to. Now they dropped the facade. They have a president who loves them and supports them, and they love him back. And when he visited, I was there when Trump visited. It was a love affair. It was disgusting. But they can say whatever they do, and they do. There is no two-state solution. The settlements are never leaving. Good. We knew that already. Now, are we okay with an apartheid regime? Or is this going to be a democracy? That's the conversation we want to have, because now it is absolutely clear that it is an apartheid regime. It has been intended to be an apartheid regime from the very beginning, and that is exactly what is unacceptable. That is what we won't stand for. And I think now that it's so clear that this whole facade of an Israel that loves peace and an Israel that only wants peace, that facade has been tossed away, then we can have this honest conversation. Is it going to be an apartheid regime, or is it going to be a democracy? Now, you know, Jill touched on the BDS issue. I don't know if you saw or heard Chuck Schumer gave a talk at some Jewish organization, I think it was in June. And he referred to the BDS movement as this modern type of anti-Semitism, kind of a sly, secret kind of form of anti-Semitism, which pretends to, you know, want good things, but is really deep down a form of anti-Semitism. If we look at the goals of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, they're declared, they're written, it's very simple. Ending the occupation, the military occupation, which is something the international community has been demanding for decades. Equal rights for the Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel, which is something that should have happened and should have been demanded, but you know, people think it's already there. And the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and their land, which again has been accepted by the international community and enshrined in a UN resolution. Where's the racism? It doesn't even mention Jews. Where's the anti-Semitism? It doesn't talk about persecution, killing, kicking anybody out. Where's the anti-Semitism? Where's the racism? What are they talking about? What are they talking about? Three very simple, very reasonable, remedial demands. They don't even deal with the problem, which is the settler colonial people like myself, the Jews that live in Palestine. It's all remedial. It's all to bring the Palestinians back to where they need to be. There is no discussion, there is no demand. There's not even a demand for reparations, which I believe should be. Maybe that'll be the, once that happens, then maybe people in America will wake up and start discussing reparations for blacks, as they should have done a long time ago. But there's not even a demand for reparations. Where's the racism? What is all this nonsense? It's complete and utter nonsense. There was a There was a conference in Jerusalem last year. How to fight the BDS. Sponsored by Yediot Ahronot, which is a big Israeli newspaper, and Stand With Us, which has an organization that has very deep pockets, and a few other organizations. And I was in Jerusalem, so I attended. I signed up and I attended. You know, there's a story about the about a witch that goes to visit a village, or not a village, a city, and she puts a little drug in the water, in the well, that makes people crazy. So everybody who drank from the well became crazy, but the king had his own well. So he was the only one that wasn't crazy, but because everybody became insane, they thought he was crazy, he had no choice but to drink from the well. That's how I felt in that conference. Thousands of people who were absolutely nuts, who lived in a reality that is unbelievable. There's no occupation. There's no injustice. We did nothing wrong. It's all anti-Semitism. It's all terrorism. And by the way, there were Mossad operatives who were there speaking. It was an all-day event. All the top people in Israel were there. The president, all the way down. Members of Knesset, journalists. Ron Lauder was there, Jewish billionaire. And the Mossad operative said, the Mossad has not yet used all of its tools to fight this, because this is a form of terrorism. And the face of this terrorism is Omar Barghouti. I don't know if you know, but he's the kindest, gentlest man you'll ever meet. And Ali Abu Nima, who runs the Electronic Intifada, another very kind, gentle man that wouldn't hurt a fly. Those are the faces of this terrorism. And there were thousands, thousands of people there. Free food, really good food. I mean, it was insane. So the press was there. And they really do not see that anything is wrong. So there's anti-Semitism, and then there's a few innocent, naive Jews who have been pulled into this. That's the BDS. You know, they plan to fight it. And they've done, the TV, Israeli TV has done programs on it, and so on and so forth. Which goes to show, you know, if you don't know anything about the BDS movement and its successes and its and the campaigns it's had, it goes to show that it's working. Because they're terrified. And if they can't kill it, they don't know what to do with it. They don't know what to do with an enemy that they can't kill. And you can't kill the BDS movement. There's nothing to kill. Who are they going to kill? Everybody? Even if they did, God forbid, you know, harm Omar Barghouti, who lives in Palestine, that won't be the end of the BDS movement. They don't know what to do with it if they can't kill it, and they can't kill it, and it's being very successful. More and more churches here in America are voting to divest. More and more people are boycotting. Boycotting HP, boycotting Veolia around the world, boycotting Caterpillar. There are many successful campaigns. People are divesting in Europe. Banks are divesting from Israeli companies. Pension plans are divesting from Israeli companies and so on. So they're feeling it. Even the defense industry has seen around a 40% decline in sales, which is significant. Dealing with Israel has become toxic. It's just become unpleasant. It's not good for public opinion. There's plenty of work to do. Don't worry, they're selling plenty of guns. But there's still, the campaigns are working very, very well. Like I said, Mikorot, the Israeli Water Authority, is out there selling itself in third world countries as this, you know, wonderful system of making the desert bloom. So that's now being targeted as well. But also, I mean, what's more basic and simple than boycotting? You go to the store, it says made in Israel, you don't buy it. Done. You've contributed to the struggle. If you want to go to the next step, you speak to the store manager and you say, look, you shouldn't have these things here because there's a boycott. If you want to take it to the next level, you get somebody to come in every single day to talk to the manager, and then you send letters every day, and suddenly they're going to say, you know, there's a headache, forget all this made in Israel stuff. You know, we're not making that much money off it anyway. And it could be an avocado, or it could be Moroccan shampoo, which, by the way, is made in Israel, or couscous, or hummus, and all the different kinds that Israel makes. And they're feeling it. They're feeling it, and they're terrified. Now, all the claims of anti-Semitism, of terrorism, of how it's not fair and violent, is complete nonsense. It is dedicated. Very dedicated. It is persistent. Very persistent. It's not going away until this is over. In other words, this movement is going to go to the very end until Palestine is free. That is absolutely clear. And that is what scares them. That is exactly what scares them. that we stand here with this. Jill's got one. Ursula in the back has got one. I mean, you know, it's something that now we're talking about and we're wearing proudly, and this is it. You know, boycotting Israel. So they're denying people to come in. So if you're an BDS activist, if they know you're a BDS activist, they don't let you come in. What are they going to do? Deny everybody eventually? So it was first it was just non-Jews. Now it's Jews too. They just denied a couple of Jews, a couple of rabbis and so forth. I mean, it's insane. They're going to deny it. So they're denying people from churches who come to see Palestine and help Palestinians. They're denying young activists who come to support Palestine. Now they're denying Jews who they suspect might be going in to deny. I mean, pretty soon they're going to have to deny everyone. It's an insane kind of... It's not paranoia because it's justified. I mean, the BDS is coming after them. The BDS is being successful. Like I said, the BDS is not going to stop until it's over. But their response is absolutely hysterical. Completely hysterical. And there's a sense that they've done nothing wrong. They're the victims here. 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are, and it's been very, very hot there this summer, dying of heat and thirst. 2 million people. Think of the hospitals. Think of newborns. Think of older people who need medical care. Think of people who need surgery. Never mind day-to-day people that need a glass of clean water. There is no clean water in Gaza. Electricity has been reduced to 2-3 hours every few days. 2 million people. We're not talking about a small town of, you know, 50,000. We're talking about 2 million people in a concentration camp. In one of the most visible, high-profile places in the world. It's 3 hours to Rome. It's 3.5 hours flight from Paris. Never mind, it's an hour drive from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, where you wouldn't dream of not having electricity, air conditioning, water. 5 minutes sometimes from Israeli towns who are along the border of Gaza, where you wouldn't dream of not having all the water you need. You know, a child has a toothache or an ear infection, you give them antibiotics. Imagine your child has an ear infection and there are no antibiotics. Never mind the bombing and the people who died from that. From that horror. Simple things. You know? So their problem is the BDS movement. That it offends their Jewish friends. The BDS is dedicated, it's the right thing to do. Israel should be boycotted completely. It should be kicked out of FIFA. It should be kicked out of the Olympics. They should not be represented in cultural affairs, academic institutions. Israel should be a pariah. It should be isolated. Being the Israeli, an Israeli diplomat, whether it's the consul general in the big cities here in the U.S., or it's the ambassador, should be the worst job in the world. And it's getting to a point where it is. They should not be welcome anywhere. There should be protests every time they show up. Hell, they should be sent back to Tel Aviv. And every decent country should call their ambassador back from Tel Aviv. That is the way it should be. And that's, I think, where it's going to go. But it's going to take a little more time and it's going to take more effort from all of us. It's not going to happen by heavenly decree. It's going to happen when we do our job. But I think it's incredibly important that we do that. That we make sure we're there, that there's always a presence. In some places in Europe, like in Ireland, for example, I know to be the Israeli ambassador is the worst job in the world. It is the worst job in the world. Nobody wants that job. In fact, Israeli diplomats had a strike about a year ago. They said they're not getting paid enough to do all this. You know, it's such a hellish job. But this is important. You know, this is incredibly important. That's how it's done. You know, South Africans didn't one day, you know, develop wings and a halo and became saints and decided to accept blacks. They were brought to their knees. Apartheid had to come down. I'm sure you know, Mandela was offered a deal in a couple of years before he was allowed out, before apartheid fell. A little compromise, this and that. He said, thank you very much. I'm going back to Robben Island. This was in the mid-80s. By 94, he was president of South Africa. Less than 10 years later, he was president of a free South Africa. But it didn't happen. It wasn't a miracle. There was a lot of hard work done in South Africa and outside of South Africa. And the South Africa was a pariah. They couldn't play rugby. They couldn't play rugby anywhere. In New Zealand, you know, they wanted this apartheid nonsense to end because they wanted to play rugby with the South Africans. They couldn't. That was one thing that pushed people to support apartheid, just to get this thing over with so we can start playing rugby again with all our friends. You know, I mean, these are the kinds of things that make a difference. So that's BDS. It's dedicated. It's the right thing to do. We should all be there. We should support it. We should push for it. We should discuss it. We should convince other people to participate in it. And when all these lunatics, corrupt lunatics like Schumer and others, you know, try to pass laws to make it illegal, and every, you know, governor after governor, state legislature after state legislature around the country pass these ridiculous laws, we should be there. Fine. Arrest all of us. Arrest all of us. Same thing is happening in Europe, by the way. More and more countries in Europe are trying to pass to criminalize the BDS. They haven't all succeeded, but they're all trying. So that is our job. That is what we need to do. Last thing I want to talk about is this issue of, everything that's Palestinian has to be delegitimized. Everything that's Palestinian has to be equated with terrorism. The resistance is terrorism. Armed resistance, of course, is terrorism because it's armed resistance. Palestinians do not have a right to bear arms and fight their oppressors. Unarmed resistance is also terrorism. Palestinians do not have a right to stand up and demand freedom. Palestinian culture is terrorism. Palestinian art is terrorism. I don't know if you know, there was this exhibit of Palestinian kids drew pictures from Gaza. That was terrorism. And the final frontier is Palestinian charities. You cannot raise money for Palestine without being equated with terrorism now. I have a book that's about to come out in a couple of months, and it's about a case called the Holy Land Foundation. The Holy Land Foundation was the largest Muslim charity in America. After 9/11, they were closed down. Their assets were frozen. Everybody thought it was just a matter of time. You know, they'd go to court, everything will be fine. They did nothing wrong. Didn't work. 2008, there was a trial. Ended with a mistrial. 2009, there was another second trial. 5 good men are in federal prison, 2 of them for 65 years. Innocent men. Muslim American Palestinians, Palestinian descent. Did nothing wrong, never heard a fly. 65 years. Appeal was denied, Supreme Court wouldn't take it, and Obama wouldn't even look at them. Now, how do you equate charity with terrorism? Who is the sick genius that thought of this? It was members of the ADL, by the way, the Anti-Defamation League, which pretends to be a civil rights organization. Really, they're a racist, fascist organization. It should be outlawed because they support terrorism. How do you equate charity with terrorism? Where do you even start? Well, they said they have an orphans program, and the orphan program supports the children of suicide bombers. Well, this was said in the trial by, Levitt. I forgot his first name. He's a terrorism expert from Washington, D.C. It's well known that if somebody knows that their families are going to be taken care of, that they would agree to become a terrorist. It makes perfect sense. If I knew that my family was going to be taken care of, I would go and blow myself up. Wouldn't everybody? This is the reasoning. But you look at the list of orphans, the case of the Holy Land Foundation, you look at the orphans and the names of the children. You look at the father's cause of death. None of them were related to terrorism. They're called shaheed because shaheed is a term of respect for the dead. So you didn't die for, it was not like they died for nothing. So the term of shaheed is not only to suicide bombers. Shaheed is somebody who dies and we respect out of respect. So none of the children's fathers had anything to do, their death had anything to do with terrorism. During the 90s, there were a lot of suicide bombers. There haven't been suicide bombers in a very long time. But in the 90s, there were suicide bombers. None of them had children. 194, 195 suicide bombers. None of them had children. So either way you look at it, none of these children being orphans has anything to do with terrorism. But why ruin a good story with the facts? These guys supported orphans. They supported terrorism. Then they said, look, they're supporting the families of prisoners. And this, by the way, is happening now all over Europe. It's happening here in the U.S. And it just happened in Palestine. Israel forced the Palestinians to close down the Palestinian National Fund, which supports the families of prisoners, among other things. They said, see, they're supporting terrorism by supporting the families of prisoners. Why are they in prison? They must be terrorists. So again, the same logic. If I know my family is going to be taken care of, I don't mind sitting in prison for 25 years. The same logic. But according to Israeli sources, forget what Palestinians are saying, because you know Palestinians are Arabs, we can't trust them, right? But look at Israeli sources. According to Israeli sources, the vast majority, over 90% of the Palestinians sitting in Israeli prisons have never been charged with acts of violence. We're talking about the Israeli military court, where the bar is set very low. The vast majority have never been charged with acts of violence. They're not terrorists anyway. They're all political prisoners. They belonged to political movements that Israel does not like. But again, why ruin a good story with the facts? And in a courthouse in the Northern District of Texas, the fact that the U.S. government said that they were terrorists, the fact that the government of Israel said they were terrorists, is good enough. So two men are in for 65 years, one for 20 years, and the two other ones for 15 years in federal prison. All of them are older than me. The youngest one, I believe, is almost 60, 59 years old. So we're talking about 20 years is a very long time. 65 years is really a life. And they're innocent. I've been to prisons. I've traveled. I've seen them in prison. So this is the final frontier, this nonsense about, and it's impossible now to raise money for Palestinians. And the need is greater and greater every day. Because of the very authority that is supposed to take care of them, which is the state of Israel, is neglecting its responsibility. Why is there such poverty anyway? Why are Palestinians living in poverty? Why do they not have jobs and water and food and so forth? Why? Because Israel has imposed the economics of apartheid on them. They're educated. Every other person in Gaza, I've been to Gaza, is a PhD. You say, but you see there's Hamas. Hamas. What you're going to do is Hamas. You can't just, let them free and they shoot rockets. Why is there Hamas? Hamas is a resistance organization. Why are there resistance organizations? Because there's oppression and occupation. The problem is not the resistance. The problem is the cause for the resistance. Yeah, but they have tunnels. Of course they have tunnels. It's locked up. There's no way to get food or water or oil or money or medicine or anything. They have to have tunnels. Why do they need tunnels? The problem is not the fact that they're digging tunnels. The problem is the fact that they need to dig tunnels. Why are they fighting? Why is there Hamas? There was no Hamas originally. It didn't come from heaven. Hamas is a part of the Palestinian resistance movement. That's why it's there. If there was no oppression, there's no resistance, there wouldn't have been Hamas. But the problem is always the victim. A victim that dares to stand, a victim that stands to rise, a victim that dares to demand justice and freedom and right. They are the problem. How dare they demand? That is always the problem. Whether it's blacks in America, whether it's in South Africa, whether it's Palestine, whether it's anywhere else where there's injustice. How dare they stand up and demand? So they are always the problem. Israel drops millions of tons of bombs, it's Hamas' fault. Because they shot a rocket. Of course they're going to shoot a rocket. You put 2 million people in a prison, they're not going to fight? How many of the 2 million people have shot rockets? Okay, not that many. Homes demolished. Homes demolished. Entire towns turned into ghost towns. Because they don't have a permit. They built without a permit. This is happening all over Palestine. They built without a permit. In Jerusalem alone, there are 15,000 homes that have a demolition order. 15,000 homes in Jerusalem only. But you know what's interesting? None of them are Jewish homes. Why, Jews don't build without a permit? I know Jews who built without a permit. I know quite a few Jews who built a balcony, a second story, a little apartment for their kids, tucked away, where the authorities can't see without a permit. You never see the army come in with these big bulldozers and destroying Jewish homes. It only happens when Palestinians have problems with the permit. If it's a Jewish permit, they get a fine. They go to court, they get an extension, they pay the permit next year. No Palestinians, no. Doesn't matter if it's the West Bank, by the way, or there, Israel proper. The bulldozers come in, the police come in with their stormtroopers, and they destroy homes. Entire villages, entire towns, between Jerusalem and Ramallah, entire towns became ghost towns. This is the great democracy that all of our taxpayers' money, by the way, is supporting. So, in conclusion, like I said in the beginning, clarity is crucial. Standing up is crucial. Speaking up is crucial. And for all of us sitting here, particularly, finding hope is crucial. We who sit here today, as they say, rich, free, and alive, all at the same time, do not have the luxury to say it's hopeless. Never mind the fact that our tax dollars are funding this disaster. But we do not have the luxury to say it's hopeless. We have to find hope, and then we have to act. We have to find hope, and we have to act. Now, it's quite simple. Like I said earlier, there are only two choices. One choice is what is the reality today, where there's a racist apartheid regime that offers me exclusive rights at the expense of Palestinians. It comes with bombing Gaza, political prisoners, people dying of thirst and heat where they shouldn't, destructions of homes, ethnic cleansing, genocide. It's a package deal. Supporting Israel is a package deal. This is Israel. There's no other kinder, gentler version of Israel. This is it. Settler colonialism 101. They invented nothing new. But there is another option. There is the option of a free, democratic Palestine. A free, democratic Palestine that respects human rights, that allows the refugees to return to their homes and their land, equal rights, without checkpoints, without soldiers, without racist laws, without a secret police, without the bombings. That is the other, there is another option. Which one of these two hopes, of these options presents hope? Everybody's got to make their own mind. It's got nothing to do with politics, it's values. Which one presents hope? Racism and genocide, or freedom and democracy? Those are the two options. I would argue that a free, democratic Palestine with equal rights is the way to go. That's where hope lies. That's why we need to support BDS. That's the banner behind which we all need to align. And thankfully, the Green Party is aligned with that. Yes. The only political party, not only in the U.S., the only Green Party, I think, in the world that has taken that courageous step, that has it in the platform. When I saw Jill at the convention, she asked me, I said to her proudly, I'm a member of a Green Party now. She said, that wouldn't happen to have anything to do with our stance on Palestine, would it? I said, yeah, well, as a matter of fact, that's exactly what. I mean, this is the only place, interestingly enough, here in the U.S. is the only place where there's a political party that does carry these things on its banner, and many other important things too. And I say this with complete confidence. If we do our job, if we act, then Palestine can absolutely be free and will absolutely be free. But we must act and we must do the right thing. Thank you all very much.